Welcome to a Talk Nation radio special on the Japan nuclear power plant disaster. I'm Dory Smith. Now, we've seen growing concern throughout the day Saturday about contamination from at least one nuclear plant and possibly two or even as many as five in Japan. One plant appears to have had damage and exposed maybe melting fuel. Now, what that means is that they were not able to cool the reactor core. There would be contamination from radioactive iodine and cesium-137. Now, as of 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the headline at CNN News, official meltdown possible. Shortly after that, their headline was meltdown underway. And right now at 8.05 p.m., what you're seeing at the CNN.com website is that a nuclear plant official has told the International Atomic Energy Agency that the reactor core is intact. Now, you can go for information on a regular basis to the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, NIRS. It's www.nirs.org. And we're joined by Michael Marriott of NIRS. Michael Marriott, welcome.
Thank you.
From what you've seen, have you gotten the sense that we've seen at least some form of core meltdown here to some level? I mean, in other words, that the reactor's been breached.
Yes, there is some evidence that fuel has begun melting. There are reports, and they seem to have been confirmed, that radioactive cesium has been detected, which would only come from melted fuel. The Japanese government is preparing, or perhaps even has already begun, distributing potassium iodine to the local population, especially children. This is to prevent thyroid cancer that would occur from exposure to iodine-131, which you also wouldn't expect to see in any significant quantity without some fuel melting. What we don't know at this point is the extent of the melting and how much has been released to the environment or may be released to the environment. The government is saying, and the utility, are saying that the basic primary containment structure, which is a steel lining around the reactor core, remains intact. Clearly, however, there are some radioactive materials getting out of that primary containment. The secondary containment, which is the concrete containment building, as probably most of the world has seen now, has been severely damaged by the explosion.
The people who were trying to cool this thing down failed. We know that. And they also tried to flood it with the same material that was used to flood Chernobyl. They flooded it. They tried to contain it with, you know, pouring concrete. And we don't know the level of success they had with that in Japan, or whether or not, given the earthquake and the limitations imposed by that, they could even attempt to use anything like what they used at the Chernobyl site.
Well, actually, right now, as we speak, they are trying to cool the plant with direct seawater that they are adding boric acid to try to bring that plant under control. We don't know. They began doing that a few hours ago. There was a tsunami warning, another tsunami warning. They had to stop. Now they've resumed that. That has some potential to keep the plant cool for at least some time. It will destroy the plant. This plant clearly will never operate again because of this. But, you know, it's clearly not over. And what's really concerning to us is that, you know, we're still only talking about this one unit at this site. The problem is there is one other unit at this site that is experiencing cooling and off-site power problems. And there are three units at the nearby Dainey site that are also experiencing cooling problems. And earlier today, Tokyo Electric Power announced that they would be venting the containments of those three reactors in order to try to relieve some of the pressure building up in there. And when you vent the containment, you do, in fact, release radiation into the air. So it's a serious step. It's not something you do, please, not something you do in routine operation. So we still have a major situation at those reactor sites.
Now, one of the things to know about this region Japan is located in, the Pacific Ring of Fire, it's a place where some continental plates come together, right? And that's why there have been these very active seismic hotspots. I'm reading this from Al Jazeera English, as a matter of fact. Evidently, you know, this is part of the problem, but, you know, they've always known this. So I want to begin to talk about now the wisdom of course, putting any kind of nuclear facility in a place like that. And then maybe you could tell us, too, Michael Marriott, about the exact type of plants we're looking at.
The concept of putting nuclear power plants in earthquake zones is not a very sound concept. I suspect that in most countries, if you tried to do that now, today, or even last week before this incident happened, that would raise some questions. These are old reactors. They were built in the 1970s, and probably without sufficient forethought as to whether this is a good idea or not. And in fact, the Japanese government and Tokyo Electric Power have been warned more than once by seismologists that these plants should have closed. This is not something that should have taken either the utility or government by surprise, that an earthquake could occur that could damage or destroy these particular plants. They have been warned about this. And TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power, actually has a very long history of covering up safety problems at its facilities. This is not a utility that has been an exemplar of transparency or anything. Japanese activists have long criticized this particular utility for safety problems at its reactors. That said, we also have reactors in our own country that are proximate to earthquake fault. In particular, Diablo Canyon and San Onofre on the Pacific Coast in California are both in very highly earthquake-prone regions. We also have a number of reactors located near the much less active but still potentially very serious New Madrid Fault in the Midwest. So we can't say here in the U.S. that we're have been a lot smarter about it.
Listeners can go to the website of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and we're speaking now with Michael Marriott of that organization. And you can see there is a Twitter feed down one side with lots of information about this leak in Japan of a nuclear facility. Plus, there's a fact sheet on the Fukushima reactors and aftermath of the Japan earthquake that's being updated, right? Why don't you tell us about your website and what people can find there, Michael?
Right. We are updating a basic fact sheet as we receive new information that we find to be reliable. That's the hardest part of this job right now, is trying to separate fact from rumor, and we're trying to stick it to facts as much as we can and use sources that we find reliable. So it's been updated every hour and a half or so today. We also have a fact sheet on the reactor design of the particular plant that exploded this morning in Japan, and it won't be comforting to most Americans to realize that we have 23 of these reactors operating currently in the United States. As far back as 1972, officials at what was then called the Atomic Energy Commission, now the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, recommended that this design be banned, precisely because the containment, it was felt then, and it clearly is the case now, that this containment structure is simply not strong enough to withstand accident conditions. This kind of condition where the fuel is heating, and pressure is building up in the reactor. So you know, these reactors are old for the most part, already in, you know, having other types of aging problems, and they suffer from a faulty design. And we think this is something that, you know, it has to be looked at pretty quickly and pretty seriously here in the United States. It doesn't take an earthquake to have an accident.
And why is nuclear so dangerous? Why don't you just go through the leading reasons? I mean, we're obviously seeing how contamination can pose a threat not only to Japan, but also, if this stuff is airborne, to, you know, as far away as that tsunami went too, which is California, perhaps even more toward America's interior.
Right. Well, we learned from the Chernobyl accident in 1986 that major nuclear accidents are not limited by geography or country boundary. In fact, the world first learned of Chernobyl when workers at a nuclear power plant in Sweden, 1,000 miles to the east, walked into work one day, and the radiation monitors went off when they walked into work, and that was because of exposure to Chernobyl radiation from Ukraine. And the plume from Chernobyl went across Western Europe. The winds changed, and it went back the other direction and came all the way across Russia and into the Pacific coast, to the extent that actually milk supplies in Oregon were interceded. They had to be destroyed because they were contaminated with radioactive iodine. Iodine tends to concentrate in milk. So nuclear accidents are global phenomena. You can't limit them to one country. Now, in what we're seeing in Japan, I can't say at this point that we are seeing radiation levels that should spark concern, for example, on the U.S. or Canadian Pacific coast. We're not seeing that yet. However, I would also caution that this is not over yet by any stretch of the imagination, and we may still see that, and that's what's of concern. I have no doubt that the workers in Japan, the plant workers, and a lot of them are getting exposed to radiation right now, are doing everything they can for the worst possible case not to happen. The question is whether, quote-unquote, everything they can is going to be enough under this situation. Now, it's something we're going to have to monitor very closely in the next couple of days, because if, you know, we do have to face this worst-case scenario, then, yeah, there will be some measures that probably should be taken along the Pacific coast. I mean, at least, sheltering for a day or so, if not anything else.
Now, of course, I went to 3 pharmacies today, asking them if they had iodine tablets for use to prevent radiation poisoning. None of them had them in stock. There's one more pharmacy that we were told to try that might be more likely to have them in our area, but really they're not on the shelf. And so how much of a problem would that be for Americans? You know, again, given that we see this meltdown and maybe one or two plants as opposed to just this one that has gone critical.
It would be difficult to get enough potassium iodide to take care of the entire West Coast population, I think, within this time period. It is an over-the-counter drug. It is available at some stores, we know. It's probably being snapped up fairly quickly. It's also stockpiled at near nuclear power plants in the U.S., so there are some stockpiles, for example, in California near the Diablo Canyon and San Onofre reactors. But unless there were a major government effort to distribute it, it probably would be a pretty uneven distribution at this point.
Just again about Chernobyl, you said milk, and there was someone on my Facebook page earlier today who pointed out about the milk that it could be contaminated, and that's how some people got radiation sickness after Chernobyl, and that, you know, they shouldn't really be drinking the milk right after such an event. And we don't know how far that extends. Obviously, you mentioned the U.S., U.S. milk during Chernobyl. And so maybe people should get some canned milk, some powdered milk, and bring it home and put it in a nice glass jar, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it couldn't hurt. I mean, again, at this point, we're not making that kind of advice because what we're seeing so far, the levels aren't that high. At this point, we're looking at more of a Three Mile Island accident than a Chernobyl accident, if I can put it that way. Serious, but much more serious for Japan than for elsewhere. The question is, what happens in the next, say, 48 to 72 hours? I mean, that's when that kind of decision would have to be made.
Can you just explain what it is about this potassium that protects the thyroid and makes it possible for people to try to avoid thyroid cancer, which is the worst one to get if you've been exposed to nuclear fallout or radiation poisoning?
I'm not a doctor, but my understanding of how it works is that it's basically a non-radioactive form of iodine, and when you take it, it sort of fills your body up with iodine so that when the radioactive iodine comes in, there's really nowhere. Your body's already taken in all the iodine it can, so it doesn't take in the radioactive one.
You're listening to a Talk Nation Radio special about the nuclear disaster we're watching unfold in Japan. And as of 5:30 a.m. Asian time, the cooling water levels in number 3 reactor had failed at the Fukushima number 1 plant in Japan. That means the inside pressure had begun to rise, and emergency reports were immediately filed. Now, what they're saying is that as many as 160,000 Japanese people may have had at least some exposure. Now, this is going on 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 12th of March, and we're on Eastern Standard Time. And scientists concerned that it's difficult to cool a reactor with use of seawater dumping on the outside. The question remains, can they cool the inside? And they're not yet seeing evidence that that has been able to be accomplished. So we have to say that they are concerned, scientists are concerned, that the potential does exist for at least some level of a meltdown unless they can cool these plants, and they are working frantically to do so. Talk to us now finally about the possibilities, for what we've seen and what you think could happen. Let's say if things are contained or versus if things go, continue to go critical here. I mean, this is on an earthquake fault, and we've seen earthquakes rumbling throughout the island of Japan, basically marking off more than half the country over the last 24 hours.
Yeah, I mean, it's, they've experienced, I think I heard on the news this morning, 600 aftershocks already. There could be more aftershocks. And it's often been said in relation to aftershocks affecting buildings and cities, for example, after structures have been through this kind of event and continue to receive these kinds of aftershocks, that they may become more unstable. And it takes less and less to cause problems. And the same thing is going to be true at a nuclear power plant. There remains a possibility of aftershocks that could affect this plant. There apparently remains at least some possibility of more tsunami-like waves. As I mentioned earlier, the utility had to stop bringing seawater into the plant because of tsunami problems earlier today, just a few hours ago. So the natural part of this disaster doesn't seem to be over either. But again, I do want to make the point that in this case, this accident has been caused by the earthquake and related tsunami. It doesn't, however, require a natural disaster to cause a nuclear accident. neither Three Mile Island nor Chernobyl were caused by natural disasters. They were caused by very different types of initiating factors. And the fact remains that nuclear power is a exceedingly dangerous technology, and that certainly all of the reactors of this particular design, if they end up in a situation where the core is heating and they can't cool it. In this case, by the way, the initiating factor is something called station blackout. All nuclear power plants require off-site electrical power to run all the systems of the plant. When you lose power, they have these very large diesel generators, emergency diesel generators, to run the plant safety system. Now, in this case, the diesel generators failed because they were essentially wiped out by the tsunami. In many cases in the U.S., these diesel generators have failed for all kinds of mechanical reasons. They also don't tend to last real long because they're operating at very high speed, and they're very big, complex pieces of machinery, and they break down. So, we could have the same kind of situation at a U.S. reactor without an earthquake, without a hurricane or tornado or any other of the kinds of natural disasters you have, and still end up in the kind of situation where you have an explosion and a release of radiation.
Well, let's just bring listeners up to date here now on the news we're getting. Even though the various officials from Japan, the chief cabinet secretary, and others have said that we're not in a situation where residents of Japan face health damage, they have in fact evacuated, I think it's well in excess now of 90,000 people, right? Do you have up-to-date numbers?
The numbers we have are, and this is provided by the International Atomic Energy Agency, so if anything it should be conservative, is 140,000 people have been evacuated to date, and the evacuation is not finished.
That's the military that we understand went in. We also know, however, that there were five plants that were at risk, according to officials in Japan. And that, even though the plants shut down when the quake hit, what we are seeing here is a problem of cooling them all. I know there was venting of five of these plants. In the one case where the plant has apparently gone critical, at least to some extent, we're facing a possible meltdown. They tried various ways to contain the heat, in other words, to achieve cooling, which prevents the meltdown. And as far as we know now, with only moderate success, if any. There is, as you've said, plant one and plant two right adjacent to one another. And so, just fill us in on any details that you can about what I've just said, Michael Marriott.
Well, our understanding, best information that we have is that there are still three reactors at the Fukushima Daini site, which is the four reactor site, site not where the plant exploded, but the other site. Three of the reactors there have experiencing cooling problems, and Tokyo Electric Power said a few hours ago that they planned to vent the containments at all three of these reactors. That will cause release of some levels of radiation. There's no question about it, and it's a problem. And we don't know if that will solve the problem. The plant that exploded, they tried venting that first, too, and it didn't help. So this situation remains very fluid. Under normal circumstances, if even one of these reactors were venting the way it is, it would receive worldwide attention. And the fact that we have three of them is really quite extraordinary.
Now, I don't know about everybody else, but what immediately came to mind for me was the China Syndrome film that made a great point of, how do you put these out? And I guess we are seeing that to an extent. In that film, of course, Jack Lemmon terrified that once this began, it would just continue to burn into the earth and no one could stop it. Can you just characterize what we're looking at here, you know, from what you know, you know, from your work at the Nuclear Information and Resource Service?
Well, what we're looking at is, you know, a lot of nuclear plant workers who are probably exhausted and being exposed to relatively significant levels of radiation, trying to make sure that their reactors don't cause a calamity. And the fact that we have you know, three reactors at one site and two reactors at a site just 6 miles away, all experiencing this at the same time, is, again, I'll just have to use the word again, extraordinary. Any one of these events would be receiving worldwide news if it happened on its own, and we have this going on, and this utility and these poor plant workers have this going on at five at the same time. You know, we are not out of the woods on this. Any of these reactors could still suffer failure of their primary containment. There could still be very significant radiation releases. We hope they're able to get the situation under control, but at this point, it is not possible to say it's under control. And I think, you know, one of the most telling things about that is no government in the world would evacuate 140,000 people from an earthquake zone in the midst of a natural disaster, because remember, this country has just experienced a terrible disaster on its own terms, and no government would evacuate people and, you know, put in the emergency personnel necessary to do that unless the threat were extremely grave. And I think that's probably the best measure of how to signify just how great the government perceives the threat from these reactors to be at this point, is that they are doing this evacuation.
What kinds of things come to mind for you that we can do to try to recover and prevent this kind of tragedy?
I could answer that on two levels, I guess. I mean, when we're talking about Japan specifically, I think we need to see how this plays out over the next few days. With some luck, we've seen the worst of this accident already, and we can turn our attention to earthquake relief and, you know, other, you know, sort of more typical humanitarian efforts. If things go another way, Japan might need some much more serious help. That Japan, you know, could end up with, as is the case in Eastern Europe, significant parts of a country uninhabitable. We'll have to see how that plays out. On another level, though, I think we also think about protecting ourselves. And to me, what that means for the United States is making sure that we don't make the same mistakes and that we don't, for example, build new reactors in this country. And yet we have a Congress that's been considering whether to increase government loans to private utilities to build new reactors, and doing that, in fact, in this age of budget cutting. And we are running a campaign to stop Congress from doing that and tell them, you know, we don't want our money spent on giving money out to nuclear power utilities.
The website again is NIRS.org. That's the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. And we've been speaking with Michael Marriott. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Our website is talknationradio.org. We produce the show in Storrs, Connecticut, and it's syndicated with Pacifica Network.